start the recording. And it's going.
Okay. So what I'll be going on.
I've got it.
Okay. So what I'll be going over with you this afternoon are the general test development concepts that are important when developing a multiple choice exam. And specifically, we'll be going over the item writing guidelines. So when you go back to write the items, you should be adhering to these guidelines that that we'll be going over today. Now, in test development, there are three major concerns that we have: validity, reliability, and objectivity. Validity refers to whether or not your test is measuring what it's supposed to in regard to the construct and the content. And as exam committee members, your role in supporting the validity of this exam is huge. You'll be the ones writing the items and making the decisions of whether or not they go on the exam. So every item that goes on your test should represent a very specific aspect of your content domain. The other big concern is the reliability, and this refers to the amount of confidence we have in the accuracy of the test scores and ultimately the pass and fail outcomes. And this is partially dependent on the amount of measurement error that the test has. Measurement error is the amount of uncertainty that's associated with any test score. It's a test, and it's not a perfect measuring instrument. It's not as if we're, measuring someone's height or, measuring their weight. We're trying to measure something that's much more intangible than that. And so our goal in terms of trying to improve reliability is to try and minimize the amount of measurement error that the test has. And this is why we go over the item writing guidelines. Studies have shown that when items are written, when they're written adhering to these guidelines, they're the ones that produce the least amount of measurement error. The third term, objectivity, this is the basis for criterion reference testing. We want to produce objective scores. We want the measurement of each examinee to be independent of all the other examinees. Their pass or fail outcome should be dependent solely on whether they can achieve the standard that you set. And this passing standard that you set is going to be based on the content as they're represented by the test items, and not on how a certain group of examinees perform. Now, other things we consider when developing a test are the content areas, the skill areas, and the item taxonomy levels. Now, you've already identified your major content areas, the HTP methods, theory, client session, case management, and ethical and professional standards. The skill areas are some of the skills that you may be trying to test with some of your items. Perhaps diagnosis of problems or, how to manage problems. And the third, the item taxonomy levels. And this refers generally to the cognitive skill that's needed by the examinee to answer the item correctly. And there are three major item taxonomy levels: recall items, interpretation items, and problem-solving items. Now, with a recall item, it's pretty much what the name implies. All the examinee needs is to remember a specific fact or concept, and that's all they need to answer the item correctly. So here we have an example of a recall item. Which of the following describes the active growth phase of the cycle of normal human hair growth? Recall items tend to be straightforward, the type of item that the examinee either knows or they don't. It's not something that they can try and figure out. An interpretive item, you're going to give the examinee a bit of information, maybe a patient history, maybe some images. you're going to give them information that they have to interpret in order to come up with the right response. So maybe these are the sort of items that are asking for a diagnosis or a prognosis. And so the example that we have here actually comes from a dental exam. It describes a patient. They come in with some swelling and some pain on swallowing, and they give you the diagnosis that it's an abscess, but given the information that's in this stem, where exactly is the abscess located? A problem-solving item is going to take an interpretation item a step further. The examinee is going to have to use a base of knowledge to interpret data and then solve a problem. And with problem-solving items, they're likely you're asking the examinee likely to make a critical decision, perhaps how to go forward with treatment or managing the problem. So the example we have here for a problem-solving item, a young child comes in. We give them some clinical or lab data. And given all of this information, what does the child require? All right. Now we're going to talk more about the actual item writing guidelines for multiple choice items. These items are going to be made up of largely two parts. The first part is the stem, and this is the part that presents the problem to be solved. The second part are the item options, and generally we recommend a total of four item options, one correct response or best response, and then three distractors. The stem can take generally one of three formats. It can ask a straightforward question, or it can give an incomplete statement, or the third format is a scenario where you provide information and then you ask a question or you give an incomplete statement. Again, the item options, there should be one correct or best answer, and you all need to agree on what it is. Because if the experts can't agree on what it is, what chance do the examinees have? And for the distractors, they need to be logical misconceptions of the best answer. And when I get feedback from item writers, they tell me that this is probably the hardest part about item writing. You have to anticipate how someone with only partial knowledge of the content is going to respond to an item. And then that needs to be your distractors. And I appreciate how difficult it can be to write these items. So the distractors need to be logical misconceptions. They need to be plausible. Again, items should have one best answer. We want to avoid any items that are based on an opinion. There should be general agreement in your community as to what the best answer is. Each item should focus on a single issue, fact, or problem. Whatever concept it is you're trying to test, it should be presented in the stem. And a good rule of thumb is to cover up the item options, read the stem, and if you can come up with a tentative response without looking at the item options, then your item is in good shape. Items should test important and pertinent material while avoiding trivial facts. This is particularly true for recall items. Sometimes recall items can border on trivial. So when you're writing a recall item and you're deciding whether or not to put it on the exam, you should ask yourselves, is this a fact that you really expect your examinees to know? Obviously, we want good grammar, punctuation, and spelling. And I want you to attempt to write interpretation and problem-solving items. It's those items that are most representative of what you actually do in practice. And so those are the items that we want on your test. Avoid any overly specific knowledge, excess information, and especially teaching in the STEM. We don't want to explain or define anything that your examinee should already know if they're sitting for the exam. Include the central idea and most of the text in the STEM. We want these items as clean as possible, particularly the item options. The STEM should be stated positively. We want to avoid any negative phrasing. So this includes things like which of the following is not, all the following except. It's not typical of the way most people think. We're asking them to think a bit backwards when you phrase something negatively. And we're not out to confuse the examinees. We want to be as clear as possible. And that's simply stating STEMs in a positive format. Use terminology that's common to practice. Avoid taking things straight out of a textbook. And we want to avoid the personal pronouns, particularly you. It's generally not considered appropriate for a testing environment. We don't want to know what you would do. Next, we want to know what should be done next. For the item options, the responses should be organized in a logical order. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean alphabetical order, but perhaps if the item options are numbers, they should be in increasing or decreasing order. Or perhaps if the item options are events, they should be in a chronological order. The responses should also be independent and not overlapping. This is particularly true if the item options are ranges of numbers. The ranges should be completely independent. There shouldn't be any overlap. We also want the responses to be fairly consistent in length. We should be keeping an eye out that the keyed response isn't the most detailed response, thereby cueing that it's the right one. The item options should also be homogeneous or parallel in content. And again, all the responses should be plausible. We also want to avoid words like always and never in the item options. It's a test-taking technique. The examinees will avoid any item options with those words because they're rarely true. We also want to avoid responses with all of the above or none of the above. And so now we have, we're going to do a little exercise now. I'm going to show you some items, and then if any of you could point out where the item goes wrong. Okay, so here we have the first item.
And remember, you'll need to do star 7 so that you can speak.
So anyone notice something about this item?
So is this an example of one that is teaching?
Okay, well, someone said something, but I couldn't quite hear it. So we're going to go forward.
I asked if this might be an example of one that is teaching, that is providing extra information.
Yeah, unfortunately, I can't hear you when you speak.
Yeah.
I get interference.
Yeah, that was pretty severe interference, I'm thinking. Everyone experienced that?
Okay. Okay, so I'll just go through these one by one. So for this first item, we should all notice that it's a negatively phrased stem. It's an except. So generally, we want to avoid items like this. Also, option C is the only one with proper punctuation. And so it's tipping off the examinees that C is probably the right answer. Here we have a second item, and we'll give you a minute to read it over. Okay, and the first thing we should notice about this item is that there's teaching in the stem. That first sentence in the stem, whoever's taking this particular exam should probably already know what that type of arthritis is. So this item would probably work just as well taking that first sentence out. Also in the stem, that last word, A, it's a tip that C is probably not the right answer because your item option should complete the incomplete sentence that's in the stem. So to avoid things like this, when you're writing a stem and some of your distractors start with both vowels and consonants, you want to, in the stem, say A and then in parentheses, the N. The A in the stem is also a tip that B is likely not the right answer because it doesn't need an article. And then finally, we should notice that E, option E, is all of the above. And again, we want to avoid using this as a possible item option. If E were the correct response for this item, as an examinee, I would only need to notice that both A and B are correct, and I wouldn't even have to look at C and D, and I would get this item right. And as an examinee, I may not have known that C and D were also correct, and so now your item is also teaching me. Here we have a third item. Here, with this item, we should notice that, first of all, the items are overlapping. The items are, the intervals are also not equal. Generally, we want the intervals to be equal. They're also not organized in a logical order. And here we have, I think this is the last sample item that we have. And what we should be noticing here is that none of the above is one of the item options. And this is something that we want to avoid. Now, as a test taker, I may believe that the capital of Texas is Fort Worth. And so I'm going to answer D, none of the above. I'm going to get this item right, despite the fact that I'm wrong. So this is the reason why we want to avoid none of the above. Are there questions or comments so far? Okay. So when we're actually putting together the test, what is the best test design? I want you to imagine a line that represents item difficulty. And on the towards the left of this line are easy items, and as we move along to the right of this line, the items become more difficult. Let's also imagine we have two people, person A and person B. And let's say that we know that person A is less able and should not pass your exam. This is a person that should not be certified. And that person B is more able, and this is a person who should be certified. So the exam that you give should help us discriminate between these two people. And this generally means we want items of medium difficulty. So any items where generally between 30% and 80% of your candidates are getting the item right, those are the types of items that we want. If we were to make the exam too easy, if we had a lot of items where 80% or more were getting the items right, that's probably not going to help us distinguish between the unqualified and the qualified. With that type of test, you're potentially going to pass someone who should be failing. We also want to avoid making the exam too difficult. Items where only, you know, less than 30% of the examinees are getting it right, those are probably too hard. And with this scenario, you're going to potentially fail someone who should be passing. Most exams that are given are a variable fixed test. You'll have a few easy items and a few hard items, but the majority are going to be that medium difficulty. And that's where you want them, because you want to make the distinction between the qualified and the unqualified. Are there other questions or comments?
Yes, will the testees be allowed to use references? Will this be an open book test or a closed book?
I was under the assumption that this would be closed book.
Okay. Thanks.
Other questions or comments or concerns?
Yeah, how many questions will be on this test that we'll have to come up with?
I think 100 was mentioned. Is that right, Chris?
Our plan is 100 on the test, but we're planning to create more than 200 questions, and then we will select questions from the pool. And actually, I think the question process will become kind of ongoing, and particularly as we pilot the test, we'll have to revise. We may have to replace some questions, so it will be somewhat ongoing. But for the test, it will be 100 questions.
Okay.
Hi, Lisa.
I don't think Lisa's on the line.
Oh, I don't know who I'm talking to. This is Lenny. Got in late because I just now found out about the time change.
Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah. So will the test come in a sealed package, and then we take it to a proctor and then open it in front of them? Is that how it goes?
Yeah. We haven't actually determined what the exact test logistics will be. It will probably start out something like that, either that or you'll determine the location, and then the test will be sent to the location, and the proctor will administrate it. But what we're really focused on today is what's involved in writing the questions and writing a good question.
That's just the number one question that's been going on in my neighborhood. So,
okay. Yeah, I think that's how it is. But ultimately what we'd like to do is a computer-based testing where people can go to a testing center, which are actually pretty readily available, and take the test on their computer system. It's basically, I don't want to say online, because it's not just available on the internet where someone can go take it, but but it's a computer form.
Okay. Now, to mute me, I go star six?
That's right.
Okay.
So I have a thought with it. Maybe we could try to kind of create an example question. Would you be willing to go through that with us a little bit, Lydia?
Sure.
Okay. I looked through the survey that we have and the tasks that we have, and one that actually kind of ranked the highest was it's in the area of let me just double check. It's the standards of practice or ethics and professional standards, and the idea is maintain client confidentiality. So I think it'd be helpful for everybody if we just went through an example of how we might write a question based on that. And I'd like to call for anybody who feels like they have an idea to unmute themselves and participate.
I have a situation that comes up frequently. You take care of a client who mentions that they're now struggling with cancer. And in the goodness of your heart, you want to notify the church and have their name on a prayer chain. Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Yeah.
Okay. So that would be the situation. Now, do you want, is that an interpretive or a problem type question?
Well, it depends on what the question is. Is the question what you need to do before you do something like that, or?
All right. I'll put on, and you, I guess that wouldn't have enough answers. I was trying to figure out how to do it so that there would be is this an appropriate action for a certified practitioner? Do you want answers like before you do this you should, or
how about your client, your first time client comes in and admits she was just diagnosed with cancer, hasn't told anyone. Your first response is cry with her, or scenarios like that. Which would be the best response for the practitioner, not for you, but as a practitioner, but the best response, leave the room and call the church, put her on the prayer chain, or, have some plausible scenarios.
Okay.
I think that's a great situation, and it is really common.
And so under the task or heading of maintaining client confidentiality, it's which actions would be appropriate in terms of either securing permission or maintaining confidentiality, respecting the client's confidentiality. So that's how you'd need to phrase it. You'd need to create a stem.
Right, and this is Jana. You'd have to be more specific even. You'd have to say according to the Healing Touch Code of Ethics.
Okay.
Well, this is Lenny. My response to that would be, because this is what I have my clients do, I have a little release form allowing me to go to the church and put their name on the prayer list.
Well, they absolutely have to give permission. You can't
just
take that action on your own, and that's what's spelled out in the Code of Ethics as well.
Yeah, that's how I'm following the Code of Ethics, at least what I thought was appropriate.
But again, you're going
to like this. First of all, I ask them, would they like to be on the prayer list? And then if they say yes, have them sign the little release form.
Okay, but understand that you're not going to have all of the steps you normally engage in. You're going to be picking from the best answer from the steps given in that question.
Right. So what would be the best, or would you ask something specific, like what would be the first thing a practitioner should do? Like sign a release would be plausible, or ask. I mean, because the question is you'd want permission or you'd want to acknowledge confidentiality. But how would you do that?
Yeah, the problem is, I think, is coming up with responses that all are plausible, but only one is right.
Yeah.
And one can't be longer than the other because that's a clue right there.
Yeah.
So I just
Chris,
drew a blank.
Yes?
I just emailed you two sample questions under case management, an easy one and a harder one. Maybe it would be helpful to read those. Can you pull up your email? And
I'm opening it.
Okay.
Okay. So it's just where it says easy and then harder, those are the two questions?
Yeah, they were just examples that I had.
Okay. So here's the first example is an easy one. A client presents to a HT session with very low back pain, impending hysterectomy, and emotionality, and requests pain relief. Which is the most likely chakra compromise? And then the options are 1, solar plexus, 2, brow, 3, sacral, and 4, heart.
That's a good item. It seems straightforward. It's clear. The responses are straightforward. Are all the distractors plausible?
I think so.
Yes, they would be, but the information given has to be distilled into choosing the best answer.
Could you repeat the question again?
Sure. Janet, would you like to read it?
I don't have it in front of me. I'm sorry, because it ails up on the computer.
Here's the question. A client presents to an HT session with very low back pain, impending hysterectomy, and emotionality, and requests pain relief. Which is the most likely chakra compromise? Answer 1 is solar plexus. Answer 2 is brow. Answer 3 is sacral. And answer 4 is heart.
Okay.
Chris, this is Victoria Stewart from Pennsylvania. The only thing that kind of flares up with me is putting them in order.
Right.
So that you're not jumping around. You're going solar plexus brow, then you're coming back to sacral, and then going to the one.
That could be an indication of which one is a correct answer?
It kind of goes back to that sample that she gave us with what age group.
Uh-huh.
You know, so if you're trying to, I used to be an accountant, so I'm used to things being lined up like that. So that may be a hindrance for me in this question, if no one else feels that way.
So what you're saying is that the item options aren't organized in a logical manner.
Right, so I would either go with brow, solar plexus, sacral, and root, if that's what you said, or root, sacral, solar plexus, and brow. You know, that's how I would follow it versus jumping from not the logical order of the chakras.
All right, that's an observation.
Also, when I've done this before, we were always told not to have the correct answer is C, because statistically C is the correct answer. So if you have to guess, you pick C.
That's true. Often B or C are probably the most common answers. So We'll keep an eye out for that when we get together and look at all the items to make sure that the key responses are distributed fairly evenly, you know, between A, B, C, and D.
Okay.
Okay.
Probably got a pretty quick statistical test to look at that, don't you, Lydia?
You know, when we're doing it on the spot, it's something that we'll just have to keep an eye on.
So, should we move to the next example question?
I think so, unless someone else has any more comments about the first one.
Okay, so here it is. This is the harder one. A client presents at the third Healing Touch session with the same complaints and assessment showing the same chakra compromise for all sessions. The client is voicing low back issues, emotionality, and ongoing relationship issues with the spouse. Previously, the practitioner has performed a chakra connection and a magnetic clearing. What method would most likely be more effective in addressing the culprit chakra? And here are the answers. 1. Chelation to open 4 levels of the energy for clearing and deeper work. 2. Chakra spread to allow for transition. 3. Pain drain over the low back to release congestion. 4. Referral to another practitioner. Would you like me to repeat it?
Yes, please.
Okay, so here it is one more time. A client presents at the third Healing Touch session with the same complaints and assessment showing the same chakra compromise for all sessions. The client is voicing low back issues, emotionality, and ongoing relationship issues with spouse. Previously, the practitioner has performed a chakra connection and a magnetic clearing. What method would most likely be more effective in addressing the culprit chakra? 1. Chelation to open 4 levels of the energy for clearing and deeper work. 2. Chakra spread to allow for transition. 3. Pain drain over the low back to release congestion. 4. Referral to another practitioner.
So why this is a harder question is it requires the practitioner to be able to look at a lot of different levels of information and put together a response based on experience and not just memorization.
Yeah, this is more of the problem-solving type.
Well,
go ahead.
Jana, I have a question on this. You gave kind of little reasons as to why you would use each one of those.
Yeah.
Is that something we need to put in there if somebody's going to be certified, or is by leaving it off, is that too hard?
I think by putting them on there, we are doing what we expect an HTCP at entry level to be able to do, which is state why the techniques are used. You could leave it off, but I don't know that you'd have the same quality of problem solving. I don't know. It was just an example.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
And Jana, in general, I like the question the way it's laid out, but I don't think, unless I was the practitioner there with that client, that I would be able to decide just on the question between A and B. I don't think there's enough information that 100% of us or 90% of us would agree on.
Well, it's best option. Which do you think is the best option?
Well, Jana, this is Lenny.
Uh-huh.
My first option would have been to do the vertebral spiral and the Hopi.
But you're not
given
that option.
Because it's a lower back issue.
Of the ones given, which do you think is the best option?
Well, I wouldn't have used any of them, you see. That's the problem. I would have immediately gone to the Hopi for a lower back issue.
But it's not just lower back. There were two
other
symptoms.
I realize that, but you one of them that you gave was pain drain to remove congestion, and I thought, well, why isn't the Hopi mentioned here?
So maybe in the wording of the question, instead of what method would most likely be more effective, it might be from the listed methods, which would
yes.
be effective.
That would help clarify that. And I would still wonder why the Hopi hadn't been used.
This is good because these are exactly the kinds of questions that we're all going to have.
Exactly. These discussions will be had for just about every item that's put forward. And they're good discussions to have.
Okay, and here's another question that was written on Jackie's first question. A client presents with cancer diagnosis. The practitioner feels the client would benefit from a prayer chain. What is the best way to achieve this? A, call the prayer chain and have them included. B, discuss with the client the prayer chain and obtain permission. C, call the prayer chain and have them included and discuss it in the next session. D, wait until the next session to make a decision.
Okay, that makes sense because they're all long and they're all plausible.
Good.
Okay.
And they're different ideas that one of them really maintains the client confidentiality because one specifies permission.
Yeah, I think that's pretty clear cut too.
I think it, this is Barbara Stark, can you hear me?
Yes.
I think it's going to take some effort on our part so that those of us who have already been established practitioners have some time to appreciate what it is the test is asking. Like I've been listening, and I think we are going to have to be really mindful that we're looking for the bottom line practitioner, I mean the base beginner newbie practitioner level of competence, and it's going to be really tricky not to write questions that are so subjective and so, well, I would do this and I would do that. And like I thought the question prior to this last one was an excellent question, but people have to be really mindful about reading all the material that's given in the question.
Well, I didn't write that question as an example of a good question. I wrote that question as an example of a really hard question. And what we're looking for is something not too easy and not too hard. But obviously, any of the questions around case management are going to be higher level than just memorization or just repeating what was in the book. So I'm glad you pointed that out because that's not exactly what I was suggesting with that.
Yeah, a task that kind of comes to mind with that would be under case management is recognizing when to refer a client.
I think if we keep case management to that kind of level, that caliber of evaluation, is the practitioner safe and responsible? Instead of giving questions that ask a lot of, well, should you do this or should you do that? Because so many of us teach in Healing Touch that intention trumps everything.
And
this
guidance,
is Jeannie in
too.
This is Jeannie in Idaho. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
My thought is if we work with the workbooks and there are things that are taken right from the workbook, you know, this is a technique, this is what it can be used for, that would catch that you know, first-level practitioner rather
Absolutely.
Than the things that have to be more intuitive.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's the intention, is that you'll take the domain of knowledge and know where it is in the different levels of workbook, be told where to find it kind of thing, and go to those workbooks as a source for question writing.
And I hope that when you write these items that they do have some sort of reference, a source.
So when we write the question, we should include for you or whoever's choosing them the source where that question came from.
Yeah, I think that's important. Again, it helps support the content validity of your exam.
Yes.
Do you want us all to write a recall, an interpretive, and a, what was the third one?
The problem solving?
Problem solving question.
Actually, what we were going to do was divide the topics up or assign the topics based on the task. And so then it would kind of be up to your interpretation to write what you felt was the best question for the task that you have.
Oh, okay.
So it could be any one of the three.
Is that true, Lydia?
Yes.
Is that how you want that?
That's a good plan. Whatever you feel is most appropriate covers that particular task, then that's the item that you should write.
Okay. But basically what we want is a variety on the test itself.
Yes.
Okay.
So I guess that would be the next thing to talk about is a little bit of the logistics of what comes next. Unless anybody has more specific questions about how to write test questions or...
Will we be getting a copy of the slides so that we have the examples right there for us to
look at? Yeah, actually, there was a copy that was sent out. It should have been sent out with the last email.
Also, it's our intention for you to get copies of the test creation handbook. The sections that relate to test question writing so that you also have that.
Oh, that would be good.
If we have, we'll put together some guidelines along with which tasks we want each person to write about. And so we'll be sending that out within, I'd like to say within the next couple of days. It may be early next week before we actually get them sent. But we'll get them put together and send out pretty quickly. And that should give you enough that you can start writing questions. But the other thing is we want to reference these to the notebook material. And so we know different people are going to have different levels of notebooks. And I've been talking with Lisa about making the notebooks available. So if people want to need to upgrade to current editions, if you're not an instructor and you maybe don't have notebooks or you have older editions and you want to upgrade to the current editions, we were talking about making those available at our cost.
Is it possible to put them online?
No,
is it possible to make them a PDF that we could access?
I don't think that we're going to do that.
Okay.
Because we'd have to reformat the whole thing that way.
Oh, okay.
But what we will do, I think, is we'll make them available. So if you need one for a specific level or you need to upgrade for a level, that people will be able to do that and only at cost, at our cost, basically. So we'll include information about that in the detailed instructions that we send out. So hopefully that'll help. Referencing the same material.
On those detailed instructions, will they have the latest issue of the handbook?
The
date or the latest issue? I think I've got them all, but just would be nice to be able to double check.
Do you mean the guidebook or do you mean the
notebook?
The notebook.
Level.
Yeah, we will put what the latest is.
Okay.
So that'll be kind of our syllabus of reference material to develop the test from. So I think that just about does it. I don't know if there are any more questions or anything that we didn't hear.
I just want to tell everyone that examples that relate to an industry that isn't necessarily our industry can really be frustrating. They can make you feel like there's no way I'm going to be able to do this. But in actuality, when we talk about the type of material that's in our program, it'll make a whole lot more sense to you. The examples in the test creation handbook are geared to healing touch. And I think that it's with a little bit of practice, it's not as big an issue or, a huge thing to have to climb this mountain. It will start to make sense, and then we'll also be able to bring these questions back and look at them again and say, oh, maybe we should rearrange that order because, you know, it's in a fallback position. We don't want it in that position of the items, or maybe we need to add a reference in this question so it's more explicit what we're asking. So, you know, this is just the beginning point here, and we don't expect everybody to be experts out of the gate, and yet I also want to reassure everybody that it's not as difficult as trying to write a question on diabetes when that's not our field.
Will the test creation handbook be an e-book or online, or will we get it hardcover or what?
We'll be sending a PDF.
Okay.
Chris, will we be expected to take the exam, the
yes.
question writers?
Yeah, yes. Everybody who's a certified practitioner will have to take the exam.
Do we include questions from some of what we consider to be required reading, such as Brew Joy's book and maybe Barbara Brennan's book?
No, we're only going to take our test questions from the curriculum material. Although some of those other items may have references from within the curriculum material. So,
yeah, for example, if in the workbook it says name the three postulates of Brewjoy and it's listed in our workbook, then that could be a potential question.
Okay.
We're just trying to keep it so that it's kind of contained, and to help keep it manageable, because we need to create a test that it's accurate, it's sufficient, but we don't want to overburden ourselves with it.
But if you look at our whole program and you boil it down to 100 questions, that's really not a lot of questions to get the whole, you know, the whole realm of our levels 1 through 5. So we're not going to be going into some of this nitty-gritty obscure stuff. We're going to stick to the main theories and methods and techniques.
The nitty-gritty and obscure stuff, that comes up and is sort of filtered out in the certification process, in the packet review. But the test is what's easy to justify for the accreditation process. So it's kind of a necessary evil in that.
And it has to be referenced, like Lydia said, it has to be referenced to your curriculum.
Absolutely.
So this is Nancy, and I have a question. I understand we're supposed to wait for this PDF on the test booklet. Are we also going to be assigned areas of interest to write tests from, or can we write tests from any level?
No, you'll be assigned because we have to make sure we cover the entire curriculum.
Okay. And will that come at the same time, the PDF?
Yeah, we'll put together. I'm working on right now assigning from the different tasks who will write questions on it. And we'll
okay.
have, we should have a minimum of 3 people will be writing a test question on each one. So we're going to ask everybody to write 4 questions. And so hopefully that's it may be a lot, but hopefully it's not too much for everybody to do.
Okay.
So Chris, this is Cynthia. If people are inspired and they're having fun and a good time writing, can they just add more questions and possibly from other areas beyond their assignment?
I don't
see why not, but they would have to put them in a separate area. They would have to submit them separately as, you know, call it over the top.
Okay.
I might also suggest that it would be good if somebody's doing really well and cranking along with the questions, maybe they volunteer to help somebody else who needs help.
Yeah.
And so we kind of keep everybody moving. But I definitely think we'll have people that maybe have more experience or background or just, a natural ability to create distractors. That seems like the tough part.
Lydia, do you think we covered it?
I do.
All right.
I think you're as prepared as you can be.
That's scary.
Yeah, well, I hope people have a good time with this.
Hey, it's only 4 questions. Doesn't
yeah.
that sound better, easier already?
All right, well, I'd like to thank Lydia for educating us and teaching us how it's done.
Thank you, Lydia.
Thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure. And I look forward. Do we have a meeting time yet when we're going to meet to review all these items?
No, we don't. And this is one of the things, I'm glad you brought it up. We're looking at a date for early November, like the first week in November, I think, when we will plan face-to-face meeting where we'll actually bring people together and we'll review all of the questions that are written, and we'll try to fix the ones that need fixing and accept the ones that we can accept. And it's we're planned for a 2-day meeting. Is that right, Lydia?
Yes.
And for those who can't travel in, there may be sections that we can do telecourse as well.
You may be able to. But the idea is at the end of that 2-day meeting, we have all of our questions formatted for the test. So we're ready to put them together in terms of the test. So behind the scenes, in that time, we should be able to put together all the logistical questions of will it come in a packet, where will it be sent, how will it be administered, all of these other things. So while all the test question writing is going on, we've got a lot of work to do. And so that's the date we're looking for, and that's about 10 weeks, 12 weeks to write questions. So it's all coming together. Things are happening quickly.
Don't feel like you have to take 12 weeks, though. If you get them done tomorrow, go ahead and send them.
And where do we send them?
You would send them to Chris, to the headquarters.
Actually,
San Antonio.
Yeah. Sue Walker has been doing our coordination, and she's been, I owe her a big thank you as well. She's been sending out the information and getting it to everybody, and I apologize again for the disconnect on the time, but it's one of those things. I looked at it and I said, yep, that's right, but there was a time conversion in it that just caught me the wrong direction. So fortunately, we did get an email out before the meeting, and everything should be recorded, so everyone will be able to catch up.
So HTP should be the collection site, though, right, for the questions?
I believe so, but we will include instructions in that for when we send out the guide.
Do we just email them in, or do you want them sent snail mail?
No, I think we can just email them.
Okay.
Any last things?
I guess just a last reminder from on my part that this is a confidential process. Part of the coherency and the legally defensible aspect of the test that we're creating is that this information stay within the group of SMEs entrusted in writing the questions. Some of them will be modified, and obviously this is just a first step in the process, but confidentiality is really important around our testing instrument.
And this is Cynthia. I just want to thank everyone for your time and your expertise, and I hope you really enjoyed the process and in helping us to determine what are the kinds of questions that will help us to determine what our practitioners should know at that entry level. I really look forward to this. I'm very excited.
All right. Thanks again, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Happy test writing.
All right. Bye, everyone.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.